Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
There's a reason why it's off market, and a lot of times it's because there's something wrong with the property that either the seller or the broker either don't want to disclose or maybe don't know about. By casting a wide net, you're able to bring those problems to the surface early, and then you can figure out if you need to deal with
them. Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Best Ever listeners, welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm Slocum Reed, and today we are bringing you another episode of our Due Diligence Show. This mini series is all about the due diligence process in commercial real estate investing during your acquisition process, especially focused on multifamily acquisitions. Today we have with us John Bombacci. He is based in Lowell, Massachusetts. He's the owner of Candor Realty. They're a vertically integrated multifamily investor and operator with both syndication and joint venture ownership structures. Their current portfolio consists of over 550 apartments. John, can you tell us a little bit more about your background and your current portfolio?
Sure. Thank you for having me. So I started off in the insurance industry. I went to college, got a good degree, spent 10 years in corporate insurance before jumping into real estate full time. The first property I bought was actually a three-family house hack when I graduated from college when I was 22. I didn't do real estate for a long time after that. But then when push came to shove, I found my way back into the industry in 2019 when we ended up going full-time real estate at that time. Ever since then, focused on building a team, focused on bigger deals, and with bigger deals comes syndication and new ways to partner in order to take down projects. The more complicated the project, the more important due diligence becomes. It's all a process. There's not much difference between a single family and a 100-unit apartment complex in terms of what could go wrong. But the cost of something going wrong is magnified by multiples. So due diligence becomes very important on the larger scale.
Yeah, of course it does. Hey, quick question. When did you graduate college and get your house hack?
I graduated college in 2010 and I got my house hack in 2011.
Gotcha. That makes sense. I'm a little older than you, but I got my house hack in 2013. Man, was it a good time to buy a house hack, for
sure.
Wish
I bought more at that time, for sure.
We all do. So the working title of this episode of the Due Diligence mini-series is Uncovering Value-Add Opportunities Through Due Diligence. I want to start by asking, John, what does opportunistic due diligence mean to you? What does that look like?
So for us, and actually we say this a lot to our sellers, is when we enter due diligence, we look for reasons to move forward before we start looking for reasons to back out. And I feel like a lot of times in this industry, people are constantly putting things under contract and then starting due diligence looking for problems. Our first time going through due diligence is we're looking for opportunities where we call the city. We ask them questions to understand what they want to happen with the building, what opportunities they might be if there's a pain point or a problem with the building. So the first 15, 20 days of our due diligence is really looking at what things are available to us at this property that might not be available to the seller. And a lot of times, because we're buying some of the worst properties in towns, just by transferring title to us, we can solve some of the problems and open up opportunities that weren't available to the prior ownership.
What are some examples of those kinds of opportunities that have come up in your portfolio?
A lot of times it comes down to conversion. So we might look at a building and it's a mixed-use building, and the prior owner wasn't able to get permission to convert it into the number of apartments that we can. Because it's a problem for the city, because it's across the street from town hall, because this particular investor is well known for all the bad things they've done, the city won't work with them. If we can enter due diligence and during due diligence open up those relations with the city and say, we're buying this building, we're solving this problem, what do you want this building to look like? Leading the conversation that way and then asking for the things we need in return tends to be very well received in a lot of the cities we do business with. A lot of people always ask, is it because you know the city going in? And the answer is most of the time we don't. It's really making that call to town hall and asking, we're buying this building. What do you want to happen here? And you'll be surprised how quickly the planning department or the building department want to sit down and talk to a new owner, want to get you introduced to the mayor or the town manager or the planning board or the economic developing director to say, I've got someone that wants to come into the town and change this parcel that's been driving us nuts. So let's take advantage of talking to this person early and convincing them to buy this parcel and helping us fix it. A lot of times the cities and the towns, they're looking for partners. If you can enter that relationship as a partner before you have any skin in the game, you'll be surprised how much progress you can make. But if you close on the building and you already inherited the problem, now the city can hold you to a new standard. But if you're going into it with nothing at risk, it's a very equal playing field conversation.
You kind of referenced this already, John, but you said you don't typically know the city before you get the property under contract. How much of a factor in your underwriting and in your offer process is it to know that local and regional government authorities are going to be agreeable to working with you on something like that?
It normally isn't. We assume the property we're buying is the property it will be in the future, but we look for opportunities to improve that asset. And that conversation with the city is normally an easy slam dunk early on, where we can say, hey, we have this industrial building that's driving the city nuts. We know it's driving the city nuts. We'd love to have a redevelopment play here, but we need some sort of assurance from the city that this is going to work. Otherwise, the building's just going to exist as what it is today. And sometimes those conversations go very well. Sometimes the conversations are just like, nope, sorry, you can't do that. The zoning's different. The neighbors aren't going to allow it. There's nothing the city can help you with. But then the building is just what we thought it was when we bought it. If we find out the building can be a lot more, that gives us extra value in that asset that wasn't available to the current owner.
So effectively, you're not talking about a change in the way the deals are underwritten necessarily, or the price that you're willing to offer for a property. It's more about adding an additional step to your due diligence process to see if engaging the city about the property and possibly changing its use is going to be of greater benefit and greater financial advantage to you and your investors than the current use, which currently pencils based on your pre-offer underwriting.
Correct. So for example, we bought a building in a small town called Gardner, Massachusetts, and it was a commercial building. It was retail on the first floor, office space on the second and third floor. We bought it for $500,000. And the underwriting was based off of it remaining 100% commercial building. It made sense at $500,000 with four commercial tenants on the first floor and office space on the second and third floor. Once we had it under contract, we talked to the city. They wanted housing. So we were able to get a permit approved to put 18 residential units on the second and third floor. And then we got a new appraisal on it with the bank. And now it's worth $3.2 million. We're in the process of doing the conversion. It's going to be a $2 million renovation budget, but we bought it for $500,000. We're putting $2 million into it, and we're sitting on a 3-2 appraisal that is already 18 months old, and the rents have gone up quite a bit over the course of the last 18 months. But again, we purchased it based off of what it was. The conversations with the city opened up a whole different dialogue about what it could be.
That's definitely an opportunistic approach to due diligence, John. That's awesome. What other opportunities do you all target, and what else have you uncovered during your due diligence processes?
Believe it or not, and this is going to be a shock to you, people don't like paying taxes. So a lot of times when we're dealing with some of our older, more seasoned landlords, we find out that there's a lot of income that is potentially off the books, whether that's laundry or parking or something. And we're very quick to dismiss it from our underwriting in terms of buying the asset because they didn't claim it. We can't count it. The bank doesn't recognize it. And then we're very quick to legitimize that money the day we buy the building. And so it might be small change here and there, but on a 132 unit apartment building we bought, it was literally $5,000 a month in laundry that was missing from the books. By recognizing that $5,000 a month or $60,000 a year on a 5 cap, that had a pretty big impact on value day one that the current owner was neglecting because they were penny wise, but dollar foolish in that approach, where they were saving the money on the $5,000 a month, but they were losing the opportunity on the resale because it wasn't legitimate income.
And again, you all underwrote that deal and it had to work based on your targeted returns without bringing to light those revenue streams, but then added bonus when you were able to actually take credit for that revenue, which increases your tax bill, but also significantly increases the value of the property.
And if we're only holding it 3 to 5 years, I want 3 years of legitimate books. So then when I go to turn this thing over, you can count it in your underwriting. And so I think it's all about the strategy. If I was going to buy this thing and hold it for 30 years and die with it in my estate, maybe I would like to avoid taxes as well. But if my goal is to maximize the return for investors in a short period of time, my incentive is to legitimize as much money as possible, as quickly as possible.
That makes sense. So we have the potential for conversion or working with the local municipality to turn the property into something that the city will find more favorable, that will have a significantly higher appraised value. We have uncovering revenue streams that are currently off the books to increase revenue, increase NOI, and the value of the property, even though it'll increase your taxes a bit in the meantime. What other big opportunities have you all been able to take advantage of?
Those are probably a lot of the ones that we look for, especially we have the knack of buying properties off of the worst landlords in cities. So we tend to find quite a bit of opportunity there where the city's not letting them do certain things because they have a bad reputation. The tenants are unhappy. Pest control needs to be done across the whole portfolio. All the tenants are very miserable because of the current setup of the buildings. So a lot of times we look at that as goodwill when we enter these relationships, and we can kind of call the city and say, we're buying this building. What do you know about it? We're new to town. We run a good shop. You can talk to some of the mayors or town managers and other cities in your state in case you want to check up on us. We're going to do our best to clean up the building. And then normally we get a lot of goodwill out of the city because of that, where we bought a big portfolio up in Lewiston, Maine, and we had squatters living in one of the abandoned buildings. There's a homeless shelter set up in one of our buildings. We did our due diligence. We built a relationship with the city early on, explained to them who we were, what we're going to do. The day of closing, they had 6 cop cars on the property to help us empty the building, put up plywood, secure it. And that wouldn't have happened if we didn't do the due diligence up front to build that relationship and get the municipality on board. So what might have taken someone else 6 months to get squatter rights removed from the property and court orders and police on site to fix a problem across the street from the town hall, we were able to resolve within 24 hours of closing because of the way we did our due diligence, because of the way we built that alignment with the municipality before we even owned the building. Does that make sense? It's unforeseen value where, because we're able to build goodwill, we're able to ask for favors, but it comes across as us doing a favor for the city as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, John. The question it's leaving me with, specific to this deal, and how long ago was this acquisition?
Lewiston was September of last year. So we're just wrapping up that portfolio now, but that was maybe 15 months ago, 16 months ago.
Gotcha. So almost a year and a half. I'm not going to ask you to remember every single number in detail from that underwriting and due diligence process, John, but the Lewiston deal, had you not been able to resolve these issues that the police came out and helped you with day one, that's a deal that still would have delivered targeted returns without that happening?
Of course. It's got to. Otherwise, we wouldn't have entered it, right? Everything we find during due diligence that makes our life easier, that's a bonus. But you have to assume that it's going to go the way that you would expect, where it's going to take you 30, 60 days to get a court date. It's going to take you 30, 60 days to get someone on site to help you deal with it. And potentially you're going to have to be paying to relocate those people in case that they are able to establish squatter rights.
Yeah, it's interesting. It also makes me very happy that I'm still investing in the Midwest where things like that don't necessarily exist.
We'll get back to the show. But first, some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. If you're an investor like me, you're probably looking for one platform to manage the banking and finance needs of your entire portfolio. The good news is there is one. It's called Baselane. and it's the number one banking platform built for independent real estate investors that reduces busy work so you can focus on growing your business. With Baselane, you can earn up to a 4.19% annual percentage yield and 5% cash back on debit card spending with no monthly fees. With a simplified view of your cash flow and expenses, you can retire those tedious spreadsheets. You can also manage unlimited virtual accounts and cards, and even open separate accounts for each property or unit. Join more than 40,000 real estate investors who trust Baselane for their banking, property management, and bookkeeping. Head over to baselane.com/Joe and sign up today for a chance to win a $500 Amazon gift card. That's baselane.com/Joe.
John, these are really helpful examples and ideas that I know all of our listeners will gain some value from hearing, and hopefully some of them will have the opportunity to implement in due diligence processes in the beginning. I'd like to reframe the conversation now. We have a fairly sophisticated listener base, John, so they've probably been through due diligence on commercial real estate before, and they are accustomed to a conventional due diligence process. And for those of you listeners who are not, feel free to Google it. Feel free to go to bestevercre.com and search due diligence and check out some of the resources that are available there. John, let's start with that conventional due diligence process as a baseline. Putting yourself in the perspective of having just gotten an LOI accepted, getting ready to get an actual contract signed and get a property tied up, how does your approach to due diligence from the onset differ from the conventional approach? I know that you said you're going to proactively reach out to local government authorities to see if there are other opportunities available for what this property could be. You're going to look for not just confirming the financial figures that you've been given, but also trying to find the revenue that's being generated off the books. What other things are parts of your due diligence process that lead to more value-add opportunities?
The standard due diligence process, I would say, we get an LOI, we walk every single unit before we sign a formal contract. And then once we sign a formal contract, we tell everybody and their mother about us buying this property, which I think it differs from a lot of people who try to keep things secret because they're afraid someone's going to swoop in and steal it from the seller. But we feel very confident in our contract. We feel very confident in the rapport that we built with the seller, that we tell everybody about the property. We call brokers, we call agents, we tell our whole network, we call the city, we call the town, we call insurance agents. We tell everybody we know about it. And then inevitably, believe it or not, it's not that big of a secret. People know the building. People have walked the building. People know where the skeletons are buried. People know what concerned the prior owner, the prior guy that tried to get it developed. There's a story out there, especially when you're entering a market that you don't know all that well. And so we've been saved from a lot of heartache, from a lot of deals, by opening up to our network and saying, who knows something about this building that we don't know? And I think part of it is just we like to think that we're getting a deal of a lifetime. We don't want anyone to steal it from us. But I think we've gotten wise enough to know people know about this building. There's some problems with it. Let's try to get ahead of those problems. And the easiest way to do that is to broadcast it and let people bring it to you. The off-market deal is great, but there's a reason why it's off-market. And a lot of times it's because there's something wrong with the property that either the seller or the broker either don't want to disclose or maybe don't know about. By casting a wide net, you're able to bring those problems to the surface early, and then you can figure out if you need to deal with them. One of our best deals, there was a structural problem, but by understanding what the structural problem was, we were able to get a structural engineer on site early in the due diligence process. They were able to confirm that it wasn't that big of a deal. The property had stopped moving. There was some temporary settling from when it was built 50 years ago. It hasn't moved since. And the problem that scared three or four buyers away before that found out about it late in the due diligence process and had to make a go, don't go decision based off of a gut feeling, we were able to nip in the bud early in the process with 30 days left in our due diligence, and we were able to overcome that issue because we found out about it early enough to do something about it. The problem with due diligence, if you find out of a problem too late, you have this this gut reaction to either over negotiate and maybe get yourself out of the contract or cut bait and run. If you find out of the project early on, your team can spend 30 days trying to solve the problem. And that can be the difference between moving forward with the deal versus not.
Getting the LOI signed, then walking every unit, then signing the legally binding purchase contract. And then once you have the property tied up, tell everyone that you've got it so that you can let everyone who knows about that property turn over rocks and tell you the things that they've already uncovered.
Yeah, because I promise you, you're not the first one to walk that property and someone sold that property to the other seller. There's some skeletons there.
I love that. That makes so much sense, especially coming into commercial from the residential world. I sometimes get frustrated with how long it takes to get from LOI to purchase contract. Do you come across sellers and brokers who are either hesitant or maybe won't even allow you to walk the units or disturb their current tenants until you have a PSA signed?
Very rarely. Sometimes it happens, but in those scenarios, we just say, all right, fine, we'll sign a PNS that's contingent on satisfactory walkthrough of all units. And that essentially makes the PNS garbage. And so you have two options. You either sign that, in which case, don't really get anything out of it, or let us walk it all in advance, and then you have a real contract.
We're going down a bit of a rabbit hole here, John, but I have to ask one more question.
Yeah.
The only other thing about that contract, when it has the walkthrough or physical inspection contingency, is earnest money and when it goes hard. I know at least in Cincinnati, there are still sellers and listing brokers who are trying to get hard earnest money day one or hard earnest money very quickly, faster than we were accustomed to pre-COVID, because last year and the year before is the seller's expectation, not the market of the moment necessarily, because it's not as advantageous to them. But are you thinking through LOI, then walkthroughs, then PSA? Are you putting down hard earnest money day one when that contract is signed?
Very rarely. Most of the time, if we're getting pushed for hard deposits, we'll make the money go hard after due diligence is normally the way that we write our contracts. So I'll give you your 100 grand or whatever it is you're looking for. It'll go hard once we finish due diligence. And then we enter our financing stage. And so you're protected against us failing on financing, but I won't give people hard money without being able to do my due diligence first.
That makes a lot of sense. And honestly feels like the way that it should be. Frankly, whether you're a buyer or a seller, that feels to me like it ought to be the expectation that the buyer will get to do their due diligence process. But as soon as they're done, money goes hard.
And maybe we've lost some deals because of that. But I'd say it's a risk versus reward conversation. And very rarely in the commercial space are you truly finding something that no one else has looked at. And so we're always very protective of money going hard. And the way that we try to protect that is making sure that if we're going hard, we're moving to closing. And we've never not closed on a property once we've gotten through due diligence and have made the commitment that we're going to move forward with buying it.
Awesome. Well, John, being that this is the due diligence mini series for the Best Ever podcast, I'd like to try to summarize at least what I've learned from our conversation, and then we will head into the end of this episode. There are a couple of key ideas or things here that I want to touch on. The first is that you tell sellers, whenever you can be direct to them, or listing brokers, that your due diligence process is about finding opportunity as much as it is about finding flaw. But also that is created by the fact that you're doing your walkthroughs before you have a signed PSA. So you guys have a really solid idea of what it is that you're buying before you're signing the legally binding contract. The moment you sign it, you tell everyone you're buying this property. That includes all of the investors locally, everyone in your sphere, but also it includes local government authorities so that they have the opportunity to weigh in during your due diligence process on whether or not there are any issues of the property that haven't been discovered yet, but also whether or not there are any conversion opportunities or things that you could do to the property that the city would grant permission for that would vastly increase the value of that property or the NOI. The two biggest opportunities that you have come across that you think our listeners should be watching for during the due diligence process are those conversion opportunities and the opportunity to engage the local municipality in general in advance of the acquisition, whether it's because you want to convert a property to increase value, or you know you're going to need to work with the city to resolve issues currently going on at the property based on how it was operated prior to your acquisition. The other big one, though, is making sure that you are finding the undocumented revenue that is currently in place at the property. Previous owners were keeping some revenue off the books to reduce their tax burden during ownership. You find that revenue, get it on the books, it increases your NOI and it increases the value of the property in return, making your sale or your refinance towards the end of your business plan that much juicier. John, assuming I've done a decent job of summarizing most of what you said, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I don't think so. I think the biggest thing that I stress to people is one of the things I always say is build a strong team early on. The stronger your team, the easier this gets. I feel like a lot of times in real estate, we like to compete against each other. We like the competition. We like it being us versus them. And I try to broach the other way. Bring as many people in as you can. Ask for help as often as you can. And that's how you get ahead of the game. I think the lone wolf in this industry has a really hard time. I think if you make it a habit to ask for help and make yourself a little bit vulnerable at certain instances, saying, I don't know everything. What do you know? You inevitably find out things you don't know that you would find out 30 days after closing. And so it's better to get that information up front, even if you feel like it's exposing you a little bit. Real estate's a big ego business. I think the sooner you can kill your ego, the easier it becomes.
That makes a lot of sense. And we're going to call that your best ever advice. John, one last question real quick. Where can our listeners get in touch with you?
Yeah, the easiest way is our website, kendallrealty.com. And then I'm also on Instagram, john.bombacci. My Facebook profile is full, so you can't find me there anymore. But I'm big on Instagram. I'm big on social media. You can also find me kicking around on BiggerPockets most days where I spend a lot of time in the forums.
Awesome. Those links are in the show notes. John, thank you. Best ever listeners, thank you as well for tuning in to our due diligence mini-series today, learning about the opportunities we can uncover during the due diligence process. If you gained value from this episode, please do subscribe to our show and leave us a 5-star review and tell a friend about this episode so they can learn the same things that you have today. Thank you and have a best ever day.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to be back sometime soon.
Hi, best ever listeners, Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access. And you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.